It's Monday, May the 2nd, 2016, and you're listening to Monday Morning Meetings on Migration, a conversation about migration and politics at the University of Amsterdam. I'm Darshan Vigneshwaran, and today we begin our sixth episode with a discussion of the migration of unaccompanied minors to Europe. Recent news coverage has suggested that the number of unaccompanied young migrants seeking asylum in Europe has been on the rise, reaching almost 100,000 in 2015. The Guardian recently reported that over 150 unaccompanied children from Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, and other countries are still stranded under terrible conditions in Calais, and called on the UK Home Office to provide safe passage to Britain to reunite them with their relatives. Things came to a head in the UK House of Lords last Tuesday when the government narrowly defeated a cross-party motion to accept some 3,000 child migrants from mainland Europe. Here to help us think through these developments, Elaine Chase, a senior lecturer in education, health and international development at the University College London. Hi Elaine, thanks for joining us.
Okay, it's a pleasure.
Elaine, perhaps you could begin by providing us with some background to these events. Why are so many young people now taking the journey to Europe on their own?
Okay, I think people make the journey to Europe and the UK for many complex reasons. We live in a world of constant transition and change, and lives can become unsustainable overnight, really, due to persecution, conflict, war, famine, drought, or a whole host of other sort of economic and political factors. We have to remember, I think, that the majority of people fleeing such situations never even step foot in Europe, but move to other neighbouring countries. And it is, in fact, some of the lowest income countries in the world that host the majority of people who flee their own countries. Having said that, there does appear to be an increasing number of young people making the journey to Europe alone. And from our experience, this is for many different reasons. It can depend on the country of origin. It also depends on young people's personal circumstances. So sometimes young people make the decision themselves to leave, for example, to avoid being forced to take part in armed conflict or conscription. Or otherwise decisions are made for them by or in negotiation with other family members. Their movement, for example, may be seen as part of a project to secure a better future and a safer future for the whole family. I think importantly in the UK case, while there's been an increase in applications for asylum from unaccompanied minors since 2010, recently this only takes us to the level of applications that we received in the early 2000s. By comparison with other EU member states, very few applications for asylum are received from unaccompanied migrant young people in the UK. We average about 3,000 a year, whereas Sweden, for example, received 35,000 applications from young people in 2015 alone. And whilst the unusual examples of six-year-olds travelling alone grab a lot of media attention, it's really important to remember the fact that the significant proportion of minors arriving in Europe are actually aged between 16 and 17 years. And this has important implications for them as they approach the age of 18 and become adults, that is in institutional terms, so they stop being children. Our research, which is funded by the Economic and Social Research Council, is called the Becoming Adult Project, and it focuses on the outcomes for independent migrant young people as they make that transition at 18 years.
So what makes young independent migrants any different from adults and families taking the same journey? I'm assuming that they have similar sorts of protections under the Refugee Convention, or are there other circumstances, legal circumstances, that they find themselves in?
Okay, I think what I would say was that of children and young people migrating on their own, and as you indicated in your introduction, the Bureau of Investigative Journalism estimates there's some 95,000 a year. Very few of them will actually get refugee status. So in order to get that, they have to prove a well-founded fear of persecution in accordance with the Refugee Convention. That's very difficult to do. You've got to have the papers, you've got to have documentary evidence, you've got to have a very coherent and clear story as to what the basis of persecution is. So the majority of young people, certainly in the UK and probably in the rest of Europe, don't get refugee status because they can't prove that fear of persecution. So they get what's called these time-limited periods to of discretionary leave. It's in the UK, it's now called unaccompanied asylum child, asylum seeking child leave. It's very time limited, and it's because they can't be returned because they're children. So what that means is there's that as they approach 18, then that situation changes enormously. So their situations are quite different to other adults and families claiming asylum, even though they'll have to do the same. Adults and families would, well, the key applicant within a family would have to clearly make the basis for fear of persecution. But it's actually more complex for young people to do that. Often decisions are made for them to leave by other members of the family. They're often quite young when they arrive here and don't fully understand the complexities of the situation that they're fleeing. So if they arrive at 13, 14 or whatever, they only partially understand what's going on very often. So whilst they then, as I said earlier, then have access because of the fact that they are children to these different forms of support, once they reach 18 and if they haven't secured refugee status, then their situation becomes much more precarious.
So that's precisely the issue I wanted to talk to you about. This group of migrants who have what's in many ways a temporary form of protection. And it puts them in a very precarious situation. On the one hand, as young migrants, they're moving to a new country and their horizons are opening up in front of them. And they're also just young people who we would expect to have relatively unlimited sense about their future and their possibilities for growth and development. But at the same time, you find them in a certain form of paradox that as soon as these migrants turn 18, and this an age that's typically associated with maturity and independence, they actually become less autonomous than they were at a younger age. Why does this happen?
I think that's right. So when young people arrive in the UK or anywhere in Europe, the situation varies. They're given sort of time-limited support, really, for the fact that they are children. During that time, they'll be usually given accommodation. Depending on their age, that will be in various forms. It might be foster care. It might be semi-supported accommodation. They'll be given access to education, to housing in whatever form, and to other forms of social care, support, health facilities, etc. When they turn 18, their access to those resources and support becomes much more precarious. And if by that point they haven't actually been successful in their asylum claim, and I can talk a bit more about that in a minute, then they are actually, in many ways, even though they're making that transition to adulthood, in many ways they become even perhaps more vulnerable than they were as children, because they're at risk of losing those different types of support. They're at risk of having to stop their education, they're at risk of becoming destitute, and they're at risk of being no longer eligible for any sort of public finance support, really.
And Elaine, you say that this really has significant effects on them psychologically and on their broader well-being. I think that's how you talk about it in your research, in that this lack of an ability to think about and know about their future places these young people who've already been in situations of great precarity in yet another situation of extreme uncertainty and anxiety.
Yes, that's right. I mean, my work and work with colleagues has actually drawn this link between a sense of security and well-being that comes from a feeling that you have a secure future and you can look into a future, you can make plans for the future, you have a sense of where you've come from, who you are and where you're going in life. So young people arrive. Very often they perhaps haven't had very much access to opportunities for education or to think about possible futures, imagine possible futures. While they're here, they engage in education, they have a whole range of choices and options open to them, but for a time limited period of time. And they start to imagine futures that perhaps they couldn't imagine in their countries of origin. What happens as they approach 18, and if they don't have any secure legal status, then those futures that they started to imagine then risk sort of being taken away from them, really.
Yeah, and you also talk about a situation in which for many of these young migrants, the people who they ought to be able to trust, who you think that they would be placing most of their faith in, that is their social workers, also end up being people that they, in some ways, fear. In your research, the conversations with your respondents show that young people live under the constant feeling of being surveyed and policed, particularly by those people expected to provide the most immediate source of support. How do we make sense of this dynamic?
Yeah, I've always argued that this is due to the confusion of the role of social workers and young people that come through the asylum process and how those roles are perceived and experienced by young people. So that is, they're often a key source of support to children and young people, but they're also expected to fulfill statutory roles and responsibilities, including in relation to immigration controls, which may not always prioritise the best interests of children and young people. So I think age assessments are a clear case in point, in that social workers have to make decisions on whether or not a young person is the age they claim to be, that is, whether or not they are a child, and whether they're therefore eligible for different sources of support. These are really complex processes that can be highly subjective, since there's no sort of ethnicity sensitive or culturally sensitive baselines against which we can reliably establish children's ages. And a number of people, myself included, have argued that we really need to remove that role of age assessment from the social worker. It should be ideally being conducted by multidisciplinary teams, which are independent of that relationship between the child and the social worker. This has been raised as a possibility before. It's I guess, more resource intensive. So it's never actually gone anywhere, but it certainly has been discussed as a policy intervention. So young people become confused about these different roles. They don't always trust where the social worker is sitting in relation to statutory services, and therefore they have fears about opening up and sharing elements of their lives. I think it's an example of how immigration control has infiltrated many aspects of statutory care support services, including healthcare, education, and housing. I think it's also, though, really important to emphasise that some young people talk about very, very positive relationships with social workers, that they trust them enormously, and that the social workers have gone out of their way to give them the best possible support that they can, and often beyond their duties and responsibilities. So it's a really mixed bag in terms of experience on young people's part.
One of the other things in that mixed bag which your research raises is the way in which migrant children respond to the bureaucracies that are responsible for their care. And I wanted to ask you, the last thing is, how they make sense of their relationship with these large bureaucracies, like the healthcare system, immigration or education systems. In your research, you show some of your respondents learn ways of sort of playing the system, as we would expect children to do, from using loopholes in the asylum application to relying on support networks. Could you give us some more examples of these strategies and how, I guess, migrant agency comes out in these sorts of stories?
Yeah. I mean, I think the loopholes are very tight in the immigration system. But I think what our research is beginning to demonstrate, and we're only partway through the work at the moment, is that young people will do what they have to do in order to establish a viable future. They have particular goals that they're trying to fulfill, either for themselves or for collective goals for family, back home perhaps. And this is, I think, exemplified by some of the research and some of the experiences that we've talked about in our research. And during those processes, young people are subjected to highly complex systems of immigration control, which are intertwined with social support. And so the social support is very much contingent on what their legal status is. These are always changing at the ages of 16, 18, if they're able to stay for that long, at the age of 21. These shifts happen on an individual level, depending on their age and legal status, but also in response to the macro level and political landscape that's happening either at a national level or at the European level or internationally. So in many respects, young people have no control over the processes that they're subjected to, so they find ways to navigate them as best they can. So examples, I suppose, are where young people fear that they may risk deportation. They know that they've become what we call appeal rights exhausted, so they can no longer place another appeal to remain, say, in the UK. And they know then that they're probably going to engage in a process whereby they have to sign on at very regular intervals at the Home Office so that they can be monitored over time and their whereabouts is known. So what many young people decide to do is disengage from all statutory services. They forego any accommodation that they might have during that time, and they lose contact with statutory services. They may find support, or they look for support within their own communities, or they'll move to different cities, or they may even move beyond the UK to other parts of Europe to try and sustain some sort of life within Europe, rather than risk the situation where they're being monitored and therefore become deportable.
Thanks, Elaine. I mean, one last thing that I'd like you to touch on before we close. I mean, your research to me seems to represent some of the what I find best in migration studies in terms of its ability to combine real theoretical sophistication with a real public policy agenda. So you're consistently engaged in what's happening in the public debate and the public domain. And given that, I'd like you to sort of engage back with what's happening in the public debate on this issue on unaccompanied minors in the UK at the moment, and provide your sorts of suggestions as to what the public should be doing, what government should be doing to respond to this situation. I know that in your previous work, you've specifically argued against the idea of return as being a durable solution for many unaccompanied minors. What would you say at the present? What do you think message should be sent out?
I think this is a really complex area. We've argued that return as a default position as a durable solution goes against young people's actual lived experiences. So that it is tied up with the idea that young people belong in the countries that they came from originally. And it's tied up with the idea that there's some sort of viable future for them back in those countries. That may be the case in the future, but currently, as we know from the emerging data that's coming out of returns to Afghanistan, for example, that there is really no viable future for young people that have been returned. This government has returned more than 2,000 unaccompanied minors back to Afghanistan after they've turned 18 over the last sort of 8 years or so. A recent report by the Refugee Support Network has been tracking their outcomes post-return and demonstrated just how difficult it is to find safety, find security. And in fact, what that report shows is that young people are even more vulnerable because of the fact that they've been in the UK and they've been in Europe. I think the point that I would make is that at the moment, the focus has been importantly on the unaccompanied child. We talk about children the whole time. And that whilst that is important, we need to really engage effectively with what is a realistic and meaningful policy response for these young people once they make that transition from being children to becoming adults. And that's something that policy at national and international levels are not engaging with at all. We believe that the net result will be many thousands of disenfranchised young people circling the globe in search of the ever elusive viable futures that they want. And in our view, that's not a sustainable or durable solution for anybody.
Well, thanks, Elaine. For those of you interested in finding out more about Elaine's research, you can find her articles at her staff page on the website of the University College London. Monday Morning Meetings on Migration is a podcast run by the Institute for Migration and Ethnic Studies at the University of Amsterdam. You can access us at our blog, 4mpodcast.com, and also through iTunes. You can also sign up for updates through our Twitter and Facebook accounts. And if you have suggestions about a story you'd like us to feature or would like to post an audio rejoinder to something that has been said on a previous podcast, please send us an email at imes@uva.nl.